This is Sidebar, where we break away from the echo chamber to give you the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society, and predict what they mean for your future.
Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Sidebar's Future of Litigation season, where we look at how the digital revolution is affecting the conduct of disputes and what the wider impact of this could be. I'm Lawrence Lieberman, Disputes and Investigations Partner at Taylor Wessing, and in this episode, we'll be weighing up the case for case prediction software. I'm joined by my colleague, Senior Associate Stephanie High, and co-founder of litigation analytics software provider Solomonic, Gideon Cohen. Let's kick things off with Gideon explaining what case prediction software is.
So I think whenever one is approaching this topic, it's important to keep two ideas in one's head at the same time. That is because there are tremendous opportunities from leveraging litigation data, but one also has to be really careful not to over rely on that data or to read in excessively to what it seems like the data is telling you. The way we see data operating in this context is really as an additional person in the conversation. I think until now, the sort of default position has been you have the client having a conversation with the litigation lawyer. That conversation is based, obviously, the client has the things that they're interested in finding out about. Prospects at trial, yes, but also things like, what do you think our chances are of settling this? And how long is it all going to take? And how much is it all going to cost? And you have a litigation lawyer who's answering those questions, often based on a lot of experience, sort of an extensive track record, and a good intuitive sense of what some of the answers to those questions are likely to be. Until now, what that conversation has been lacking is a sort of check on that sense of the intuitive views of the lawyer by reference to data in cases that have actually happened. And what we see the data doing, what our customers, I think, see the data doing for them is not to say the data can do this in isolation from or as an alternative to the lawyer, but rather that the data and the sort of predictive algorithms and all the rest of it can be there in order to provide an additional perspective to say, well, it's interesting that your intuition tells you these are the sorts of prospects for this case. How do you place that in the context of what tends to happen on average for cases with these features? And that could be, say, whether you're talking about what might happen at trial, but also a whole range of other potentially even more important factors that can be looked at from a data prism for each case. So I think the advantage to the client is, if you like, the reassurance of knowing that there's data there and that that data is part of the conversation. And also sometimes the disciplining of the lawyer's views by reference to the data, not, as I say, that the data, as it were, somehow trumps what the lawyer thinks by reference to the particular facts of an individual case, but that the data acts as a way to test the lawyer's views and for the lawyer to really think hard about how his views sit alongside the data that's out there.
And just sort of developing that a bit more in terms of the benefits to the client, do you see that the use of case prediction software will result in cost savings for clients? Is that something which you anticipate will follow?
I think the answer is yes, and in probably in two different senses. So part of, and this perhaps isn't specifically about case prediction, but about data a little bit more generally, part of what leveraging litigation data can do is to save costs on particular tasks. So it can enable you to say, you know, traditionally I'd have done all these searches to see, all the previous times that this particular point came up and to try to see if I can learn anything from those instances to think about the case that I'm concerned with. And there is just now a much quicker way to do that kind of research task by reference to litigation data. So in that very direct sense, it's a time saver and a cost saver. I think there's a broader sense in which it at least might be, although I think you'll probably be interesting once people start doing work and reporting on this to see how far this is right. But the more you know, both about the merits of your case and how, you know, those sit in a sort of historical and data context, and about things like the other side's previous litigation behavior, it ought at least in theory to be the case that it becomes clearer to both sides what a sensible resolution to a dispute would be and what they can expect the other side to do in the course of the dispute. And therefore, ultimately, it should be easier to amicably settle, or whether amicably or not, settle disputes at an earlier stage and before a lot of the cost has been incurred. Now, I say that, I'll acknowledge that it is rank speculation as to whether that actually will turn out to be the case. But that is, if you like, a second broader way in which I think there are at least exciting possibilities once the technology is being used by a wide enough segment of the market where there's a sort of equality of arms and people are seeing on both sides of the table what the data has to say.
Gideon, I'm interested in your take on how we should be, or if we should be, managing clients' expectations about how beneficial this could be. Particularly, I'm thinking about if we've got very complex disputes with lots of points. And what I understand from what you said is this is particularly useful if you're dealing with particular points in a case. You know, you want to look at precedent on a particular point that's arisen. But if clients are expecting to be able to shortcut the entire process on a very complex dispute and say, you know, this is the dispute, what's the outcome going to be, and, you know, what's my prospects of success, and can I shortcut all of the legal fees? Seems to me that's sort of where we need to be managing the client's expectations as to what it is, the purpose of the software is, and what we can do with it.
I heartily agree. I mean, there may be, I think, scope in, and this is sort of, I guess, what you were getting at when you say some cases are much more complicated than others. In more straightforward cases, there may well be more scope to do it by the numbers, as it were, and to, in effect, you might have some kind of human check on what the algorithm is predicting, but ultimately the algorithm will do as good as or a better job than the human in analyzing the universe of data that's out there and drawing conclusions from that. In the world where we're sort of primarily interested, i.e. high value, typically quite complex commercial disputes, I think at least as things stand, and one never wants to, you know, rule out the interesting ways in which technology might advance, but at least as things stand, I think that's probably not the most helpful way to think about it. And I think it's probably much more helpful to think about it in this way, that when we look at relatively large data sets, if you describe to me, or to our algorithm, I should say, half a dozen features of a case, the algorithm would be very good at telling you of the next 100 cases of that type, how many are likely to succeed. But there is still a significant gap between telling you that and telling you, by reference to a sample size of one, the particular case that you're interested in, what's going to happen. And that's really why I started by saying one needs to keep, in our view, two ideas in one's head at the same time. On the one hand, we think it's tremendously valuable to have that perspective, if you like, that baseline view of how, on average, particular sorts of claims behave, and to use that as a starting point to think about the particular claim that you're looking at. On the other hand, I think to treat that starting point as an end point and to assume that based on a number of key characteristics, you can know what will happen if a claim goes to trial would be profoundly dangerous. I think that the good news on that, I guess, is twofold. The first is, at least speaking for us, and I imagine that others, you know, if there are others in doing some of the same work, they would do this as well. A large part of what we do is to try to explain how statistically significant or predictable something is. So it's not just to say, here's our best guess of what might happen. It's also to give the user a sense of the penumbra of uncertainty that sits, you know, as part of that, and to give you a sense of, okay, you know, how confident can I be just using these data points that this is what's likely to happen? And how much do I need to perhaps quite extensively draw on my own view of the particular facts of this case and really move the needle in one direction or the other in thinking about what's most likely to happen? I think the other thing just to mention is precisely because we are talking about a world of complex, high-value disputes, and often quite data sophisticated clients, I don't think we've yet had a lot of people saying to us, and that I suppose could be for all sorts of reasons, but I don't think we've yet had a lot of people saying to us, you know, clients are latching onto this too much, as it were, are saying, why do I need the rest of the analytical process if I've got this machine that gives me a sort of sense of what on average is most likely to happen. And I think as long as we're talking about those really complex disputes, it probably is a happy corollary of that, that we're talking about, you know, sophisticated, and particularly data sophisticated clients who obviously dealing with lawyers who are both sophisticated and increasingly data sophisticated themselves will not be prone to, as it were, overreach in terms of some of the conclusions they can make in an individual case based on average data.
Yeah, and especially from what you've described, the software itself, or, you know, the output is self-explaining the limitations and the statistical significance.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the idea anyway.
There was something which occurred to me, which is the point in time in the dispute that one might consider the use of case prediction software, because clearly one can see the case for it being used at the pre-action stage. So in other words, on the decision as to whether to even litigate at all. And I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts, Gideon, on whether you see it being used at that stage. And then related to that, as obviously at that point, you will have your client's view of it and your client's documents and so on. But as the case progresses and you start to see more of the evidence and so on, and even perhaps, you know, who your trial judge might be and all of those sorts of things, as the case goes on and you get more information on the case, does it become more useful the more data you can put into it?
Yeah, I think broadly the answer to that is yes. You know, clearly, as with anything like this, the more data you have, the more you can do with it. I suppose in some ways it could be most useful at the earliest stage because the decisions that are being taken then are so fundamental, you know, in particular, the most basic decision of all of whether to start proceedings or not. And sometimes at that stage, even if you don't know a huge amount about it, a case, the data can play quite an important role, even if it's just in supporting the lawyer in the conversation that they're having with their client. Where we see the particular kinds of claim, or for instance, particular kinds of arbitration appeal that have a very low rate of success on average, that can be quite a helpful aid for a lawyer who's trying to, you know, convince their client that it's not just the lawyer being a bit wet, you know, the odds really are stacked against them if they proceed with a particular type of claim, just to take a kind of hypothetical example. So it might not be doing as much predictive work then. Its use as an explanatory tool to assist the lawyer in some ways might be greater. So I think that you're absolutely right that there's a general theme that as you know more and more about the case, and indeed about the people involved in it, including who the judge is going to be and also who the lawyers on the other side are going to be and all these sorts of things, the more you know, the more there will be there in terms of the ability to leverage the data. But sometimes, even when you know relatively little about the case, the ability to place one's opinions in a data context can still have a really important bearing on those really fundamental decisions that are made very early on.
Yeah, something I was thinking about is decisions whether or not to make certain applications along the way. So thinking about things like summary judgment and what have you. It's sort of a midpoint where you've got a bit of information, but you know, you're not necessarily that far along. Presumably it's just going to help at those sort of key strategic points as to whether or not it's going to be worth making those applications.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all about those different stages, if you like, in the life cycle of a case. And it's not the sort of thing that necessarily you'll find yourself using every day. It's more the sort of thing where at the end of a piece of litigation that might have lasted, you know, a year, 2 years, however long it is, you will be able to look back and say, right, here were the 7 or 8 times that I was able to really get some high value insights, whether it's, you know, the very beginning or whether it's something like considering an application or whatever it might be, some high value insight that really helped to complement the analysis and the client conversations that were taking place at that stage.
You're listening to Sidebar. Subscribe now for the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society, and what they mean for your future.
Can I move us on to a sort of related topic, but a question which is probably quite a career limiting one. In fact, this whole conversation feels a bit like that at the moment, which is, can case prediction software ever be more accurate than a human? And I suppose related to that is, what are the things that a human can do and will always be able to do that a machine can't? And Steph, please help me out here. Let's hope that you've got some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think building on what Gideon said at the start, I think the data has shown that if you've got a very straightforward claim, and you know, I'm thinking about things here like PPI mis-selling claims, and that there's studies have shown that the AI, you know, can be more accurate than a human if you pit one against the other. But I think what we've been exploring so far is actually when you've got particularly complex cases, actually that's where you're going to need the experience, and you know, you're going to need us to explore the various strategies and work it out. And actually that's where the AI is going to be, you know, or the data is going to be a sense check on what we're thinking, as opposed to the driving mechanism as to what the right decision should be. So I don't think we're there yet, but that's not to say that we won't get there one day. I'm thinking more the sort of low value, straightforward cases where there perhaps isn't complex detail, you know, there aren't complex factual issues or expert issues, that then in those circumstances, I imagine it can be very cost effective.
I think the thing that I think about as well is, I mean, this is all still very new. Gideon, this business hasn't even been around for that long. And so we're all, as a profession, exploring it and exploring its limits and exploring how we like it and how clients like it and so on. But I wonder, I fear perhaps, about once it is well established, even though that experience, those finely balanced judgment calls and decisions, the sort of intuition that good lawyers are paid for, whether you may find lawyers get lazy about relying on their own analysis, whether that's just volume of work or cost pressure or the availability of software like this. And of course, as it gets more sophisticated over time, whether the lawyers will delegate their decision making to the machine.
Yeah, sure. So I think that certainly is one possible scenario. I think it probably is a fair way off in time, if it's ever going to happen, that lawyers would be, as it were, deferring to, rather than as we see, more sort of utilizing as a tool the technology. But I think that it's a really interesting possibility to think about. I think just to counter it, though, a little bit, one of the things that we see the data sometimes doing is to shake lawyers out of a little bit of complacency. I wouldn't necessarily say laziness, but a little bit of complacency that they might currently have. And, you know, I'm thinking of it in this sort of way. We see, and this is partly anecdotal, but we see, or we understand, that when people are asked, go back to that question of prospects for success, when lawyers are asked about that, they often tend to sort of hug quite close to a 40 to 60% type range in the kinds of advice that they're giving. And if you look at the data, it actually shows that there are certain kinds of case which are relatively predictably going to succeed much less often than that, and others that will succeed much more often. But for reasons good or bad, you will very rarely find a litigation lawyer saying, I think this case has a 10% chance of success or a 90% chance of success. And this won't necessarily change that, because one of the things the lawyer might be doing is to say precisely that there are all these particular factual risks or issues in a case that mean that you can't give a really robust or really aggressive prediction in either direction. But I think the existence of the data, certainly one of the things that surprises some lawyers when we show them the prospects of success for different claims, if you look at it in an average way, really aren't bunched around the sort of 40 to 60 range in the way that people might expect. I think the existence of that data, just as an example, is something that could help to keep lawyers honest a little bit, not using that obviously in a pejorative sense, but can force lawyers to think, you know, is this really my best view of this case, or am I kind of punting a bit or hedging a bit in the advice that I give? And likewise, you know, our corporate users, I think, are using it on the other side of the table in precisely that kind of way. I don't think they are, at least not that I've heard yet, saying to lawyers, well, are you're probably wrong because the computer says X. But I think they are saying to lawyers, you know, can you really justify why you reached a conclusion that seems markedly different to that of the computer? And, you know, with an open mind as to how the lawyer is going to do that, but with a starting point that there is an exercise there that needs to be done to explain if it really is a 45% chance of success and not what the data by itself would seem to indicate, that's fine. But the onus then is on the lawyer to really explain why that is. So I think in some contexts or some scenarios, it could have the opposite effect and actually make the lawyer have to be more engaged and think through in a more rigorous way and justify in a more rigorous way the conclusions that he or she has reached.
Do you think, Gideon, it's going to lead to more emphasis on, I'm trying to think how to phrase this, sort of more human elements of things like if your witness is going to be a good witness in the box, you think they come across credibly just from sitting across them and talking to them, if they come across as knowledgeable and reliable and things like that, you know, both particularly in terms of fact witness, but also your expert witness. Do you think this will just lead to more emphasis on those sorts of factors? And those are going to become increasingly important in terms of the sort of analysis you're making in your prospects of success analysis?
Yeah, well, I think those factors are absolutely the ones where it is hardest for the data to really get a purchase on them. Not to say it's impossible. You know, there are interesting things that one can do by drilling down in particular data points as far as evidence goes. But as a general rule, I think those factors are precisely the ones where it is harder to know what effect they might have on the outcome of a particular case. I think that probably, from our point of view, means not that one doesn't try to gather data on them, but that one uses the data a little bit differently. So to come back on the example you just mentioned about expert witnesses, we don't actually gather really any data except the fact that there was expert evidence for the purpose of case prediction based on expert witnesses. But we do gather all the things that judges have said about expert witnesses, be they positive or negative. So it's data still, but it's data of a very different kind. And it's very clearly data that, as things stand at least, isn't going to be very useful to an algorithm that's trying to make a prediction, but could be quite useful to a human being trying to make sure that they've covered all the bases in seeing what's been said about a particular expert before they instruct them, for example. So those sorts of points, I think, are absolutely... I think your instinct's absolutely right. Those sorts of points are absolutely the ones that are going to be hardest to assimilate into any model. But more broadly, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no interesting data. It might just mean that one has to think about what data exists in a slightly different way.
Interesting. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the level playing field next and the sort of transparency issues that come with consideration of this topic, in the sense of, is it the case that large organizations will only be able to pay for case prediction software and multiple licenses and so on, and litigants in person, you know, wouldn't be able to access it, for example, or smaller organizations, and whether it gives a, you know, an unfair advantage in any way to litigants in the system, and whether that is something that you care about, Gideon?
Yeah, so I think we do care about some of the positive effects that this can have. And I think as a very general matter, you know, the more transparency there is into a legal system that for many people can be quite baffling, the better. I think it is absolutely fair to say, I'm not sure it so much would distinguish between or would discriminate between larger firms and smaller ones. I mean, I'm not, obviously, I don't think this is the context in which you want me to go into the details of different pricing structures and so on. But suffice it to say that, you know, there are smaller entities who find ways that work for them to subscribe. So I'm not sure that's much of a distinction. I think it's absolutely right that there will be people, thinking in particular of litigants in person, who are very unlikely, probably frankly unlikely, to even be aware that these sorts of tools exist at the moment. And I think there are a couple of things I want to say about that. The first, I guess, is that to some degree, that is not very different to the fact that litigants in person are at a disadvantage in various ways. You know, I guess the most powerful and obvious one being that, by definition, they don't have access to experienced and expert legal advice, or at least not unless they're able to get access to it in different ways, as it were, not in the conventional way of calling up and instructing a firm. So to some degree, it's not different in kind to some of the other advantages that somebody might have relative to a litigant in person. I think probably where it's a little bit different is that actually it doesn't require necessarily quite the same legal expertise that some other legal tools might do. There's certainly a learning process, and you certainly need to be very legally literate to understand how the thing works. But there's actually quite a lot that, if we think carefully about it and about how to present it, could be helpful to litigants in person as well, if one can figure out a structure through which they can find out about it and find a way in which they can sensibly get the requisite information. So I think the answer is, say, as a very general matter, I think transparency ought to be helpful. In a more on the ground way, as long as this is for any tool that larger organizations have and individuals don't, that's some degree of advantage to the larger organization, whether that's an expensive individual or a piece of kit. But I think actually probably there are more creative ways that can be explored to level up that playing field, at least to an extent, in ways that actually may be more possible than they would be if you're talking about trying to make sure everybody has access to elite legal practitioners, for example.
We were thinking about developing one last topic, and that's the question of forum shopping. And I think what's interesting about this is that, clearly in our system in England and Wales, these tools are available and having take up and so on, but that's not necessarily the case all around the world. Steph, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that or any sort of examples of where there is a difference in the use of these tools in different fora.
Yeah, so France have banned this sort of software precisely for that reason. They want to discourage or ban forum shopping. They don't think it gives parties the right to a fair and equitable procedure, is how they phrase it, and they think it affects the balance of the rights of the parties. But I think Gillian made a good point in that, you often have inequality of arms anyway in terms of the lawyers that parties are instructing. If they've got someone very experienced, they're able to afford that. And I was just thinking sort of a related around forum shopping, and often you might do that based on someone's experience anyway, or it would be a strategic point that you'll consider early on in a case. If you've got a client whose strategy is they want to delay things as long as possible, they just want to buy time, an experienced lawyer might say, in which case, why don't we try and issue this claim in a certain jurisdiction, or let's go down this arbitral route, or let's try this. I can't see this is really any different to that. I'm not sure it's perhaps as big a problem as France thinks it is.
Gideon, what's your thinking? Do you think the reaction in France is just partly knee-jerk reaction to the newness of it, and it's going to be a global phenomenon in due course?
I'm not an expert on the French law. It's not that they've banned all analytics, but they've banned certain kinds of analysis, which in a way may be an even more difficult distinction to draw.
What they've banned is it's analytics around it's the identity of data for judges and members of the judicial registry. So you basically can't analyze things based on the judge that you're getting. So that can't be used to aid in evaluation, analyzing, comparing, or predicting professional practices. That's the ban that they've got there.
Yeah. So, and I think my understanding, as I said, I'm not an expert on it, is that that came out of an initial proposal, I think, by French judges that they should be anonymized because they shouldn't be able to link a particular judgment to a particular judge. And this was, I think, hashed out as some kind of compromise position. As I say, I'm not an expert on it, but that is what I was given to understand. And I think there was some reaction to it on this side of the channel that indicated from the Law Society and others that they thought that this was not really a workable or sensible approach to take, although obviously every jurisdiction will make its own decisions. I think probably the comparison that's of more direct relevance in a way for us is with the United States. And particularly if one thinks of the various legal governing laws and jurisdiction clauses that people choose in other countries, certainly the most popular ones, in very general terms, are English law first and then various US state jurisdictions as well. In the US, this is actually much more developed as a field. Not that I'm suggesting that the products themselves are more developed than the ones we have here, but they've certainly been around for longer. And there is certainly, they are now more embedded. Indeed, part of the interest we see over here is from clients who are perhaps US-based and who are used to having the technology there, being surprised if they can't have access to some of the same tools here based on, what is ultimately obviously public data. So I think it probably depends on which particular forums one's looking at. But I think our position certainly and our understanding has been that as a very general matter, it benefits England and Wales or the UK more generally as a jurisdiction to be able to offer some of the same transparent data and data analysis that is already there in the US and that is bound to grow also in other, particularly other, although not exclusively, but particularly other common law jurisdictions. So it depends, I say, exactly which jurisdiction comparison one's making, but certainly our everything that we are hearing indicates that clients want this. Clients want more data, if I can just put it in those sort of broad terms, and that being a jurisdiction that is able to offer them that additional data and additional transparency, and therefore a feeling that, you know, these are decisions that they are making with data, is quite a powerful draw to a jurisdiction, or conversely, if one's not offering it compared to another jurisdiction, quite a powerful disadvantage for that jurisdiction. In very general terms, one of the things we hear again and again is corporate saying that these decisions around litigation are the only really high value decisions they're asked to make without data. So bringing data into the conversation is something that, apart from anything else, is just reassuring for them to know that it's at least part of what's being considered. And that is, I think, an advantage for us as a jurisdiction, an advantage perhaps even more so at the moment for the Americans in their various jurisdictions. And I think certainly from the interest we hear in various places is inevitably going to grow, albeit that, as the French example shows, it is at least possible, although I'm not sure it's likely, but it's at least possible that it might have to take slightly different forms in slightly different jurisdictions.
I think that's a really good place to conclude. It's good to know that both our jurisdiction and other developed common law jurisdictions seem to be encouraging the use of these types of tools. And I'm reassured, greatly reassured, to hear that we won't be replaced by machines anytime soon, but that actually, as you were saying, Gideon, the use of this sort of software to sense check and to provide more data input into decision making, along with the intuitive part of the job, as Steph was saying, that ability to size up a witness. I think overall, it is something which clients are going to, you know, expect their lawyers to at least think about using. And ultimately, if it leads to better decision making, both in terms of starting a piece of litigation or, as you say, you know, concluding it and when to conclude it, then that can only be a good thing.
That's it for episode 2 of the Future of Litigation season of Sidebar. A big thank you to Gideon and Stephanie for taking part and sharing their unique insights on the case for case prediction. Our Future of Litigation season continues in 2 weeks. Watch out for episode 3, arriving on Tuesday, the 9th of March.
Thank you for listening to Sidebar. Tune into our next episode by subscribing now and have the inside track on the latest legal issues and trends in business, law, and society, and what they mean for your future.